Today's topic is the third foundation of mindfulness, or the third way of establishing awareness, and that's the citta, or the mind state, mindfulness of the mind state. And as an introduction to this topic, I want to read the climax of this very large book. This is the Middle-Length Discourses, and for some of you, it might be intimidatingly large. And it must have been more so in the ancient world because there was no books. So the monastics who would study this book, they would memorize it. And it would take a long time and there's to memorize it. And in the ancient world, it's divided into three divisions, each of them about 50 suttas. And so people would first memorize the first 50. And if they had accomplished that, then they'd go on to the second 50. And then if they'd accomplished that, they'd go on to the third 50. And so it's quite an undertaking. And imagine the years it takes to really memorize and take in. And it was very important to do because it was the way the teachings were then transmitted to the next generation because there were no books to preserve it. So people would memorize it, and then part of the task was to make sure that they'd pass it on and teach other people to memorize it. So by the time, and there were different monastic groups who specialized in the different collection of texts, and there would be one group that specialized in this one, the Middle-Length Discourse. So they're the Middle-Length Discoursers. So then you're getting near the end of all this study and all this memorization, and you come to the very last sutta, and you probably know that you're coming to the end. And it's an amazing accomplishment, amazing kind of probably assimilation in your very being, these teachings. You're living with them, and you memorize something that goes in deep, and you're reflecting on them and doing together with a group. And probably it was a group effort that people would recite together, chant it together day after day. And you know you're coming to the end when you're memorizing this last piece. And you kind of can see you're coming to the very end, coming to the climax of all this. And the very last teaching the Buddha gives in all this here is, I think, is the climax. So I'm going to spare you having to read all of it. So this is the Buddha's last teaching in this great book. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is my instruction to you. That's how it ends. So first he evokes compassion. Out of compassion, the Buddha has been teaching. And it teaches compassion through seeking the welfare of his students, his disciples. He has compassion for them. And then these are the roots of trees, these empty huts, means these are places to go and meditate. And our equivalent of an empty hut is IRC. Meditate, do not delay, or else you will regret it. This is our instruction to you. So you're engaged in an ancient practice that we are also, in a sense, Buddha, of course, didn't know us, but I'm sure that he knew he was teaching for the generations to come. And in a sense, we also are the inheritors of this wonderful teaching from this wonderful religious country and religious times of the ancient world of India and from the Buddha. And these are, you know, instructions that are meant for those of us who are following this path. Go and meditate. And you are. And the Satipatthana Sutta is one of the most detailed instructions. There are others, but one of the most detailed instructions in the ancient texts for how to meditate and how to approach this. And it's quite a remarkable document that if you're uninitiated to it, if you're reading it the first time, you go down to Santa Cruz on the boardwalk and say, hey, read this. You know, you'd be lucky if they get through the first paragraph. If they get further than that, they probably fall asleep. You know, I used to fall asleep when I used to read these texts before I kind of understood what they were about. And now I find them very interesting. But the Satipatthana Sutta, I think, is a fantastic text. It's a kind of a great composition. And it's one of the more carefully composed texts in all of the suttas, probably edited by many people and composed. And, you know, we say it's the teachings of the Buddha, but that's probably comes from the Buddha. But I love it that it's so carefully composed and structured. It's a sign of someone who has been really mindful and careful and caring and kind of, there's order, there's clarity, it's kind of structure. And sometimes when we go into places that are well ordered and structured, you can relax, like, oh, yes, things are taken care of here. Or you're inspired to be mindful. And for me, when I read these texts now, I'm kind of inspired by the idea of kind of dedicated, orderly, kind of orderly is the right word, but dedicated, intentional engagement in the practice. Let's do it. This is an intentional text composed in an intentional manner. It wasn't done spontaneously as a kind of just, you know, impromptu kind of thing. And it's meant for this kind of go in the forest in an intentional way, set yourself down, and here, follow these instructions. And the instructions are about how to establish or develop awareness, my preferred translation of sati. And I'll say a little bit about, you know, again, repeating myself a little bit before about what the text actually says we do. But I want to say a little bit more about the word sati. Some many years ago now, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, I was getting into studying this more deeply, this text, and I got curious to see what this famous discourse we're reading, the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, what it actually had to say about sati. Because that's what we're, mindfulness, right? What does it actually say about mindfulness? And, you know, that seemed like a reasonable, I'm a mindfulness teacher, I should know what the text says about mindfulness. And so I went in there to read, and it said almost nothing about mindfulness. And I was like, what? Wait a minute. This is the text on mindfulness. The title of the book is a chapter about mindfulness, and it says, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness, four ways of establishing mindfulness. But then when you look at the instructions, what you're supposed to do with mindfulness, the word sati is missing. Like, what about this mindfulness stuff? So that perplexed me. So I started going through the text, the whole book and the other books, to see how the word sati is used. And it's never used as a practice that we're supposed to do. Buddha never says, do sati. And so I thought, wait a minute, you know, this is not what I learned and from my teachers. And they told me to be, you know, do the mindfulness. Let's do mindfulness and be mindful here, be mindful there. Here, mindfulness there, mindfulness. E-I-E-I-O. And so then I decided to look at the verbs, the actions that are connected to this noun, sati. And then that was interesting to see what the actions were related to it, which is kind of what you do in relationship to sati. You possess sati, one is endowed with sati, one has purity of sati. So those are all things that one has, kind of like possessions, or like, you know, kind of like you have faith. You know, you possess faith, you're endowed with faith. We don't usually do faith, like get your faith going, you know. You know, we're going to have the faith hour at 6:45 this evening, and we'll all come here and do our faith. You know, faith is something you have, and you touch into, you evoke, you you establish, you something, but you don't literally do it as an action, I don't think. So that way with sati. And the other two verbs connected to sati is to establish sati and abide in sati. So these don't have to do with possessing something, but rather you're in it. You're established in it, and you're abiding in it. And so the word, the English word, in my mind, that seems to best fit as a translation for sati with these verbs is awareness. We can be endowed with awareness. We possess awareness. We can have purity of awareness. We can abide in awareness. And we can establish awareness. And awareness is kind of a unusual animal or thing. Probably just like with consciousness, it's very closely related. No one knows what it is. And I'm a little bit fond of telling people that I'm a mindfulness teacher who doesn't know what mindfulness is. So what is awareness? And once I did the exercise of asking people at IMC one Monday night how they knew they were aware. And people in the room all said all kinds of different things. And what was really eye-opening to me was what a range of things people said. And I appreciated from that probably everyone has their own idea of what awareness is. And maybe if teachers like me say use the word awareness, or even use the word mindfulness, I bet there's like, you know, some 45 people here. I bet there are 45 ideas of thinking, you think I know what I'm saying, what I mean. We each kind of interpret it in our own way, in our own background, and so especially with vague words like awareness or consciousness. So sometimes we use these words awareness to point to something that we have to then personalize and find for ourselves. What do we find in ourselves that relates to that, that touches that? So what do you have that you can abide in, rest in? What kind of attention, what kind of knowing, what kind of perception? Do you kind of like settle back and just rest in, and it's there? You don't have to do it. It exists without having to do it, without having to, you know, you can awaken it, you can establish it, but then it's it being there. What do you have that, what kind of attentional faculty do you have that becomes clear or pure? So now it's clear. Before it was ruffled, it was agitated, it was cloudy, but now there's clarity to it. I love living in the Bay Area when looking across from Redwood City, across the bay to the hills on the other side, when the air is clear. It's so great. I forget there's hills over there. And wow, and it's crystal clear. And you know, it's the absence of smog and haze and stuff. And, you know, so that absence is so meaningful. And, you know, and then you see. So the awareness, it's absence of haze, absence of clutter. So we're talking about, you know, something I think that's innate, something we all possess, something that we can awaken or evoke or establish or make present for us. And then we can learn to make it present, and then we can learn to kind of rest in it, to abide in it, to use it to become more clearly aware of what's happening here for our life. And in this regard, so then when you look at this text more carefully and see what it tells you to do, It tells you, the verbs it tells you to do are things like to know, to clearly recognize, to observe, to feel, to experience. And all those are the activities that we do. And those are the ways of using attention, our attentional faculties. As we use them, then what follows in the wake of them, or what gets awoken in them, is a stronger and stronger awareness. So like you keep knowing, what's here, what's here, what's here, what's here. You kind of stay in the present, really stay continuously. Then over time, the clutter falls away, the preoccupations fall away, the distractions fall away, the thinking about the past and the future fall away, things get clearer and clearer. And then you start noticing, wait a minute, whoa, there's something here. There's clarity, there's awareness, there's presence, there's, not just simply knowing, but the continuous knowing got you to the awareness, got you this place of, wow, I'm really here. Some people get it like going for a hike in the woods, you know, and by the end of the day, your ordinary life has fallen away and your concerns of your ordinary life have fallen away. And then the trees and the leaves are glistening, and it's clear that your awareness is kind of heightened awareness. And it's pretty special. So what we're doing with, in order to kind of get a hang of this Satipatthana, it really helps if you get fascinated or get really interested in your inner capacity for attention. And how is it you pay attention? What kind of attentional faculties are you engaged in? What are the different ways of paying attention? Sometimes we observe, sometimes we feel and experience very intimately, sometimes we just simply have this clear recognition, clearly recognize what this is, what's happening. And these are all faculties that we use. And so this is what we're using when we are developing this awareness. Then we come to the third foundation of the foundation of the mind, the citta, or the mind state. And as Tara pointed out yesterday, there's a shift that happens in the second foundation. The first foundation is about the body. The second foundation, about the feeling tones, pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant and unpleasant. The text talks about doing it of the flesh and of not of the flesh. And not of the flesh is kind of like the mind. And there's a transition that goes from being in your body to, as you settle in, the attention shifts to something deeper. Something that's kind of not of the sense world, where there's, you know, the nerve endings in the body, but something that's kind of considered much deeper. And we could call, it's maybe called the mind, citta. Sometimes it's translated as heart. A few people will translate it as heart-mind. But it's something very intimate within. And so this journey inward to something that's, you know, more deeply yourself and you than, you know, parts of your body. You know, when you cut your fingernails, you know, you look at your fingernails on the bathroom counter. You know, is that you anymore? You know, your fingernails are just, you know, they come and they go, kind of. But what's deeper? Who are, what's going on in a deeper sense? And so the citta is, I think it's nice to call it, I like to call it the quality of our inner life. It's the atmosphere of our inner life. What atmosphere is in here? And as we start settling down and settling down, quieting down, at some point when there's less distractions, then we start noticing what's the quality of our inner life. And it, all of this, whether we're learning about what it's like to pay attention, or whether we're noticing the inner quality, it's kind of like we're beginning to shift the attention from the content of our thoughts to the deeper ways in which we know, deeper ways in which we are. So if I go around my days always with a fist like this, I can do a few things with a fist, but it's pretty limited. But I have important things to fight against, to protect myself against. I have important things to make, points to make. And so I just like, this is all I have. You know, I'm really into it. And I believe in my fist. I believe in the cause. I believe, you know, it's great. Yes. But in doing that, I don't notice that my fist is turning white, my knuckles are turning white, that, you know, that it's been held this way for so long that it's beginning, the muscles are beginning to freeze and atrophy, and, you know, and I can't really open it anymore, and, you know. But if before I get that far, if I, rather than being focused on what I'm concerned about with my fist, the good fight or the whatever it's going on, I do something radical. And that is, I notice the fist. And I notice the fist is tight and clenched and getting numb. So, well, that doesn't make sense. So then I relax the fist. I don't let go of the good fight if that's necessary, but I no longer hold the fist. Or if I'm always wanting things. I remember when our kids were small, I went to a supermarket, and it was amazing to see this wanting. Like, just, I'm small enough, I was carrying him, right? It's like, his arms would go out, you know, just grab, you know, wanting this and that. Like, it seemed like every aisle he wanted it, things. So this wanting that we have. And the same thing, we often focus on what we want from the world, or what we want to push away. And that's reasonable to want things, and reasonable to push things away. It's not like a crime or anything. It's just, but, you know, it's kind of like, don't do it all the time. what we do eventually, we learn to notice how tense and tired the hand is from always grabbing. And then, oh yeah, let's let it rest. So the same thing with the mind. So the mind is often concerned about thinking about things or feeling about things going on in the world. And we live in a world of aboutness. It's kind of like a little bit of a virtual reality. We're thinking about what's for dinner. We're thinking about, you know, what are we going to do for breakfast? We're thinking about, you know, should I go to bed at 9 or at 9:30? I'm thinking about, you know, what do the people near me think about my socks? And, you know, am I wearing the right socks for a meditation retreat? Mm-hmm. I probably made a mistake, and, you know, and probably they're all judging me for my socks. And it's all about socks after all, and because we're all looking down. And so that's like the, you know, that's the big fashion thing. Some of you have figured out not to wear socks, and you renounce that whole fashion world. And so the world is, the mind is always about something. And some of the aboutness are really important, you know. But, you know, we're thinking of important things, but it's still about. And what happens if we're always about, we're kind of objectifying the world. And even if we're thinking about ourselves, we're kind of objectifying ourselves. We're living ourselves as an object of that aboutness. And so the mind is thinking about things. And the thoughts, one of the classic little phrases, the slogans that was born early in the Western Vipassana movement, I think it was an Indian teacher who made it up, but the Westerners brought it back from India. And I think it was Manindra who said to, I think Sharon Salzberg, Manindra said, the thought of your mother is not your mother. And that kind of liberated her. And then my Zen teacher said a kind of similar thing to me when I was, you know, a young man. And he said something similar about my father. And, you know, your father is much more than what you, he's not your father. Before you was not a father, and kind of after you left home, he's more than a father. So really? I thought, you know, he's just my father. That's all he is. So we live in this aboutness. We have ideas and reference points for things. And not that they're necessarily wrong, these world ideas we have, but if that's all we're doing, we're missing something important. And so the radical thing we're doing here at this practice at some point is learning to turn the attention kind of around 380 degrees so we can look at what's really going on prior to the world of aboutness. So like with world of thinking, what is it like? What is it like to be thinking? Not what are you thinking about, but what is it like to be thinking? And I was shocked when I started noticing this to discover how exhausted my thinking was. You know, being a professional thinker, kind of incessant thinker, you know, ever since I was young, you think. I never thought of, I thought thinking was like, I didn't even know it was happening. I didn't even know I was tiring myself out. Because, you know, that's, you know, it's like, there's like, I'm so busy with the things I'm about that I didn't know that I was thinking. I was just, you know. And so to turn around and notice, wow, it's churning and energy and like, you know, wow, it's exhausting and it's spinning. And it doesn't have to be that way all the time. It's possible to relax the fist of the mind. It's possible to stop the incessant reaching of the mind for more. It's possible to relax the way the mind, you know, all this thinking that we're doing. So we're turning around to look and see what's here. One of the things in sati we're doing is turning around and looking also at how we're aware, how we're paying attention. Some people are so focused, I used to be so focused on, because of the way instructions were given to me, that you're supposed to know carefully every little thing. Just know it. In fact, one of the little analogies that my teacher used was spearing broccoli with your fork. Your mindfulness should be like spearing broccoli with a fork. Like you have an object, like your breath or something. And I guess in Burma, the broccoli, if they have it, is too well cooked. You push too hard, the broccoli breaks in pieces. But if you do too lightly, the fork doesn't go in. So you have to kind of just really penetrate just the right intensity. And so, okay, so everything that happens, a pain, a thought, I have to kind of, you know, spear it, but not too hard. You know, which, you know, it's a kind of a nice analogy in some ways. But if that's all you use, you know, that idea, then you miss something extremely important. And that is to turn the attention around and notice how you're paying attention, how you're knowing. I used to know frantically. You know, I thought the more things I knew per minute, you know, the quicker it would go. So I would just speed up, you know. You know, notes per minute kind of thing. Or I would do it loudly, aggressively, and all kinds of things. And then I learned to turn around and look at how I was doing this. And sometimes I could see the violence of it, sometimes the despair of it, sometimes the desperation of how I was knowing. And I learned to kind of, I don't have to do that anymore. There must be other ways. And so I learned to relax and relax and relax and settle. And then as I did that, what became more clear was that there is this awareness that's here to support us. We're kind of floating in a world of awareness. Like awareness is kind of like this ocean that we're swimming in or something. And I didn't have to be so much the doer of it. At some point, became more step back and allow it. And the practice, because a lot of what the mindfulness has to do is allowing yourself to be aware more than always being the doer. So then, at some point, when we're, I think for some of us, this turning around to notice and seeing what's going on more deeply inside, we become aware of the quality of our inner life, the atmosphere in there, the mood, the mental state that we have, the heart state that we have. And that's an interesting thing, that because that's something that's kind of more continuous than a lot of the things that are coming and going all the time. So like one of the mind states is that someone can have an aversive mind state. And you could see someone walking down the street sometimes, and there's a cloud of anger around them, and like, oh, this person, you know. And it's a state. And then, you know, someone says something nice or funny or something nice happens on the street, and you see the person smile for a moment. But the mood hasn't really changed. They have a moment of happiness, but the overall mood stays one way. Someone else, you see them have a mood of happiness. And something unpleasant happens, and you see that they kind of, for a moment, they scrunch up their face, or they cringe for a moment. But it doesn't affect their overall mood. So that within the mood, there can be these swings of particular mind moments, particular mind reactions that go on. And we don't have to identify the reactions, we can just see them come and they go. But kind of a wider kind of around it is the weather. The inner weather, which is a little bit more constant, stays stable, stays, can stay longer. And so sometimes as we do this practice, we become aware that there actually is a underlying mood, underlying kind of more maybe pervasive attitude about how we go about the world. A very common one that common for people who are relatively new to, especially retreat practice, to discover is how pervasive their fear is, that there's an underlying layer of fear. It's almost a mood of fear that they didn't even realize that it was always there, because, you know, we don't pay attention that much, or we're so much thinking about the aboutness, we're too busy to notice what's going on deeper. And so we start noticing, wow, it's a pervasive fear. And when people come into, you know, practice discussion with teachers, and they say that, wow, sometimes they're a little upset to realize it. But teachers, you know, we're a strange lot. You know, we're happy to hear that. You know, and so, you know, sometimes we try not to smile. But the reason we're happy is because this is the way to healing. This is the way to get beyond it. We have to meet this parts of ourselves. We have to, without meeting it and knowing it, there's no way forward. So sometimes people discover, and there are different personality types, you know, there's different ways of being. None of this is, no one's at fault for doing any of this. And so we don't have to take it personally. But, you know, these are some of the different variations. Another variation is being aversive. Some people have deep kind of mood of aversion. And it doesn't matter what comes their way, they're going to say no. No matter what comes away and what goes on. And I have a son who's like that, and since he was the smallest kid, I mean, before he could speak, it was clear that his first instinct was always, he couldn't speak, right? He would go like, shake his head, no. So we would feed him. He wasn't even old enough to feed himself. So we'd have a spoonful of his baby food, and we'd bring it up to his mouth, and first thing he would do is, nope. And so we knew, we just waited. That's all we had to do. And we wait, and then he'd open his mouth. So there, you know, that's, you know, this, you know, the no thing, or the aversion thing, or everything's wrong, or we look for what's bad, or, you know. And then there's the desire mood, the wanting. That's a little bit more my personality. For me, desires are a dime a dozen. They're so easy to have desires. They roll right through. They're free, kind of freer than a dime a dozen, and so that can be a kind of mood, wanting more, so these are kind of so at times, greed, aversion, and then in a third mood that the Buddha talked about, delusion. A general sense of confusion, a general sense of kind of floundering and unclarity of what's going on, and indecisiveness. And that could be the mood. And it can be really clear, this is how it is. And I've known people for each one of those, when they see it, what's going on, will be deeply troubled. They'll take it personally, they think they have some personal fault going on, they think that this has something that has to be fixed. So in this third foundation of the mindfulness, the Buddha instructs us to notice when there's a mind, when there's a mind state of greed, know it's a mind state of greed. When there's a mind state of aversion, know it's a mind state of aversion. When there's a mind state of delusion, know it as a mind state of delusion. That's all he says about it. He doesn't say, know it and get upset. Know it and take it personally. Know it and fix it. Know it and let go of it. He just says, know it. Know it. Know it. It's powerful. The act of knowing is powerful. The act of knowing is powerful when we keep doing it. Keep doing it. Just know this, know this. What often happens is that we know something and then we have commentary. We know something and we start thinking, what does this mean? And what does it mean about me? And what should I do? And what should I tell the teachers? You know, something. But then we've left the knowing. The idea is to know, and then for the next moment, be there for the next knowing. Don't miss it because you're thinking about the past 2 seconds ago. And so the act of knowing, oh, this is how it is. This is how it is. And there's a steadiness. There's a clarity of maintaining, oh, this is what's happening. This is what's happening. This is what's happening. And we're beginning to tap into, touch into, a capacity of the mind to not be caught up in what we know, but just to know. We have a capacity of the mind that's kind of becomes free of what is known. But if you know something, like, I'm full of desire, and you know it, and they say, well, I should go to the store and fulfill my desires. And where the closest store is. Or, I've been desiring long enough. This is rather embarrassing. You know, I've been desiring now for 10 minutes. And that's, and so I hope no one noticed. So when we go into that kind of thinking, we've left the world of knowing. The idea is stay with the knowing. Stay with the knowing. I like to think of it as like you take a ship through the water. The bow of the ship, you know, has maybe some point in the shore that's heading towards. So it's really heading there. And as it goes through the water, the water doesn't stop. It's not a wall stopping the boat, but rather the bow cuts the water, and the water just falls to the edge, the side of the boat, and washes off, kind of. So all these other things that arise, we know, and think that's like the bow, the knowing, and don't worry about all the thoughts and commentary and judgment. Just let just wash off the side, and show up for the next knowing. So to know when the mind, when the inner, there is a time will come when it becomes clear, you get this intimacy and inner sensibility to really feel like, oh, this is what my inner life is like. My inner life is full of turmoil. My inner life is full of calm. My inner life is full of fear. My inner life is contented. You know, over the days and months it changes and shifts, but oh, this is what it's like. Not the details of any given reactivity, but much more deeply, what's here? Then the Buddha said, as important as it is to know a greedy mind is a greedy mind, aversive mind is an aversive mind, a deluded mind is a deluded mind, he said you should know the opposite when that's present. When a mind is free of greed, know a mind that's free of greed. When the mind is free of aversion, know that mind, that mood that's free of aversion. When the mind is free of delusion, know that. Now, some people who live in the world of aboutness, it always has to be about something. And here we're being asked to notice the absence of something, a freedom from, and to get a sense, a feel for, a visceral, somatic, almost feel for what it's like those moments, those times, when there's no greed, that mood is absent, when there's no hatred and aversion, when there's no resentment, to know when there's no confusion, no delusion, no uncertainty, no waffling, just, and to sense and feel that, to know that clearly. These two sides, the one, greed, hate, and delusion, and the freedom from it, are very important division in Buddhist teachings. I think of them almost, they're ethical teachings, because greed, hate, and delusion are the root of all unethical behavior. And the mind states that are free of greed, hate, and delusion are the root or the source for ethical behavior. And this is one of the reasons why they say that satipatthana, the satipatthana practice, creates ethical people, because they get deeply sensitive to the workings of these deep ethical roots within us, these deep motivations, these moods that affect our choices of how we live our life. And so it's very impactful to start seeing greed, hate, and delusion operating. It's very impactful to see the absence of it. So the Buddha just says, know it. Just know it. Just know it. And then he goes on and says other things. He also says, you should know a contracted mind as a contracted mind, and a scattered mind as a scattered mind. And that's probably where fear fits in. Fear is, the mind gets really contracted or really scattered or something. And that those kinds of minds we can have, and so just know that too. I very much like the wow approach to mindfulness, as opposed to the ouch approach. It's like, wow, there's a lot of fear here. Wow, greed. Wow, hatred. As opposed to, oh, no, not again. Oh, really? Just wow. That's a little more the feeling of this, relaxed, stepping back, observing, seeing, knowing. Just knowing, like, wow, that's how it is. So contracted, scattered, afraid, know that. Then the Buddha goes on a little bit further. So there's actually eight different pairs of things that the Buddha talks about in this exercise. But now there's a switch. So the first three especially, maybe the fourth one as well, the first three have to do with more that can be seen as part of our ethical life. And the fourth one also, often can lead to unfortunate actions and things done, said. But now we switch to understanding not what's healthy and unhealthy, but what is liberating. And some people spend a lot of time, they know what's pleasant and unpleasant in terms of mind states, and what's healthy and unhealthy, and kind of keep themselves there. And so they're always moving towards states of mind that are happy, that are, full of joy or generosity or love, and these wonderful qualities. I don't want to diminish their importance. But as important as those are, and valuable as those they are, they're not the same thing as being a mind that's liberated. And so there's a switch now. There's another one of these bridges, a transition in the instructions, from this, the healthy, unhealthy, pleasant, unpleasant, ethical, unethical qualities of the mind, states of mind, to the liberating states of mind. So now we're getting into something even more deep. It's this deeper and deeper. And so this is so there's four things or pairs. The first one is one knows an expanded mind as an expanded mind. That's literally mahacitta, which could be in Zen they talk about big mind. So it could be just as well translated as one knows big mind. As big mind, expanded mind as expanded mind. And one knows a non-expanded mind as a non-expanded mind. There are times when the sense of awareness, that's why awareness is so useful, is awareness that doesn't seem to have any boundaries. You know, there's no reason why awareness should feel as if it's just bounded by our skull. Awareness has no boundaries. And with the help of our kind of imagination and spatial sense, there's a feeling that awareness kind of becomes very expansive. With my eyes closed and I sit and get concentrated, my awareness feels like it's the biggest thing in the universe. Thank you. It just, you know, just doesn't end anywhere. You know, I'm not going to claim that it doesn't end or that it goes forever and that it's that big. You know, just that I think mostly it's because the sense of the awareness of the mind being small and contracted is part of my attachments and preoccupations and things that I kind of make it feel that way. And when those things don't limit it or don't make boundaries to it, it just feels as if it's quite broad and like it can hold everything in it. That's how it feels, like everything that happens, there's lots of space for things to occur. This idea of resting in this big open awareness, it tends to come as the mind gets concentrated. So one knows, one recognizes the expansive mind, and one recognizes when the mind is not expansive. The next one one recognizes, one knows that the mind is unsurpassed, or the mind is surpassable. And what this means is that as we get deeper and deeper into states that are akin or close to liberation, there are different states of mind that one experiences. And some of them feel pretty wonderful, but if you really know them well, you say, well, you know, those are good, but inherent in them, built into them, is a sense, a motivation, a momentum, a gravitational pull, or something to go further, to not be limited by that. Even some pretty wonderful states in meditation are still limited, still have a little bit of dukkha, a little bit of tension in them. And then at some point you come to a state that said, there's nothing better than this. This is unsurpassable. And that's very important because it tends to be with very deep states of equanimity where you know now is the time to really stop trying. No more doing. No more anything. Just be. Just be. Just rest in awareness. Just be. It can't be surpassed anymore. Can't go further. So know an unsurpassable mind as an unsurpassable mind, a surpassable mind that can be surpassed as that. Then the next one the Buddha says is, know a steady mind as a steady mind, and know an unsteady mind as an unsteady mind. So to have a mind that's really steady or still, somehow the mind feels comfortable with itself, the mind-heart feels at home in itself, the heart-mind is not looking outside of itself, it's not defending itself, proving itself, the heart mind not trying to become something. The heart mind, the inner life, the inner mood, is just content to be still. Nothing to prove, nothing to get, nothing to be. Just is. Just is. Imagine this clarity of awareness. Clarity, like looking across the bay, and everything is so crystal clear because there's no fog. and everything is so still and soft and open and sweet. And then the Buddha said, one knows a liberated mind as a liberated mind, and one knows an unliberated mind as an unliberated mind. So we can also know that, well, I'm not liberated, I'm still caught, I'm still concerned about things and wanting things or doing something, or I'm still making things personal, it's all about me, myself and mine, and you know, so that's, but the beautiful thing about this practice at this point, but what is it? Just know it as it is. No judgments, no commentary, no shame. Just, oh, that's an unliberated mind. That simple. And if it is liberated, we know, that's a liberated mind. It's free. The beauty of this is because we keep just staying with a knowing. The knowing is becoming, is no longer being sticky with things. The knowing is not, we're training the mind, the knowing quality of the mind, we're training it to be present for our life with clarity and presence and intimacy, but without the stickiness of judgments and commentary and stories and taking it personally. Just know. Just know all these things. Know it. Know the state of the mind. And this is what, knowing is not a neutral thing to do. It's almost like knowing is what keeps opening to freedom. It's kind of like knowing creates the path. You know, a path in the woods is a path because it's been cleared wide enough of bushes and stuff so you can walk through. And so it's the knowing that clears the path to freedom. There's something about the moment of knowing, of clear, simple knowing, that creates space. It creates space because it allows something to be itself. It allows you to be yourself. It allows whatever there to be, just in the knowing. So there's knowing of this quality of our inner life. And one of the best ways to be the custodian, the caretakers of your inner life, is simply to know it, to see it, to understand it. And the Buddha in the beginning, I read from this text, the Buddha was teaching, you know, meditate. He was taught people to meditate, taught all these teachings out of compassion for us, out of compassion for yourself, out of love for yourself. Sit at the foot of a tree in an empty hut at IRC and have compassion for yourself, care for yourself. And one of the best ways to do that is to know yourself, know what's here. Knowing is so significant that if you really know with clarity, that knowing and love, I think, are the same thing. So this, as we get into this deeper, deeper, deeper kind of state or quality, the quality of your inner life, if you really want to be the custodian and caretakers for this quality and to find freedom and to meet it with love, know it. Just, this is what it is. This is what it is. And I don't expect that just because I say so that you can do that. But perhaps me saying so will inspire you to try it out. Do that turn 180 degrees so you're not only caught up in the world of aboutness, but you're really checking into yourself in a deeper way. How are you? How are you in your knowing? How do you know? What is the deeper mood or atmosphere inside of your quality of your inner life? What is happening here that you distract yourself when you're so concerned about the aboutness, things of the world, things about yourself? And to feel and sense, make room for it. And if some of that is difficult that's in there, make room for it to heal. Make room for it to feel that that you know it. To know and to love is the same thing. The things that are difficult inside of you, that maybe that's all they need, to be known and to be loved. And stay there, and then this knowing, just know, and in the repetition of knowing, the constancy of knowing, staying in the knowing, taking refuge in knowing, there is safety from getting distracted and caught up in other things, and there's beginning of creating the path to freedom. There is freedom in the knowing. And then tomorrow, Andrea will talk about the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is this so wonderful beginning of noticing how the magician plays its magic trick, to start seeing the inner operating activities of the mind that will either create a kind of mind state that's in bondage or a mind state that's free. So then we're getting into the deeper and deeper structures of our inner life and the operating principles. So that's for tomorrow. But you have a lot more understanding of what we're working with in the fourth foundation of mindfulness if you come to appreciate the quality of this inner life, the mind state, the heart state, and you start kind of navigating in it and understand the variety and the shifts and changes of it, and realize how it too is a conditioned phenomena that is partly conditioned by what we talked about tomorrow and the next day. So thank you. And so that you can maybe let go of the aboutness of this talk, we can sit quietly for a minute.